Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with North State and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wickman.
Today's guest was editor of the Chico News and Review from 1981 to 1991, and for a while was a journalism lecturer at Chico State University. George Thurlow has also worked as a reporter and publisher, and his coverage of Latin America has appeared in newspapers and magazines across the United States. In April 1981, he was shot on a jungle road in San Salvador, and 2 days later, George Thurlow left El Salvador to get medical treatment in the United States. He has now written a book, El Salvador, Blood on All Our Hands. George Thurlow, welcome.
Thank you.
Where were you in 1981 when you decided to go to El Salvador?
In 1981, I was working as a crime reporter at the Woodland Daily Democrat. And I think I was prompted to look at El Salvador because in December of 1980, three American nuns and church workers were killed on their way from the airport to downtown San Salvador. Shortly after that, Ronald Reagan took office as president of the United States and had indicated that he was going to hold the line in El Salvador against what he saw as Soviet incursions into Latin America. It was my firm belief that we were entering into another Vietnam War, and I wanted to go to El Salvador and report on what was happening there.
So how did we justify involvement in El Salvador, in their civil war?
Well, our involvement in Central America has been long and not very pretty. I mean, our government overthrew a popularly elected president in Guatemala, and we were firmly entrenched with anti-communist politicians throughout Latin America. Reagan said, essentially, if we don't stop the communists in El Salvador, they'll be at our border of Texas. And he justified our intervention as essentially trying to halt what he called the spread of communism. In fact, what was going on was long-time authoritarian regimes were being challenged by popular forces, labor unions, church groups, and liberal progressive political forces in those countries.
My guest is George Thurlow, and he has written a book, El Salvador, Blood on All Our Hands. So you decide to go to El Salvador, and was it what happened to the nuns? Was that what instigated your interest and your desire to go to El Salvador?
I think that was part of it. I mean, it was an incredibly shocking event to have, three American nuns and church workers clearly murdered by Salvadoran military forces. And the reaction of the U.S. government was the Ronald Reagan administration essentially said at the end of the day, they said, well, they got what they deserved. But it was also the idea that it appeared that we were going to soon be sending military forces and weapons to El Salvador. And of course, we were also, Reagan was also supporting anti-Nicaraguan government forces, the Contras, in their attempts to overthrow the government in Managua. So the whole region was essentially on fire.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you went down there, you took something with you. You wore something, and you took something. And what did you wear?
Oh boy, that's well. And it's been long enough that I can't get anybody in trouble. The chief of police of the Woodland Police Department loaned me his bulletproof vest. And I wore it. I had to wear it entering the country because they confiscated bulletproof vests from journalists under the guise of saying, you're giving these to the guerrillas and we can't allow any bulletproof vests in. So I wore the bulletproof vest in. I was not wearing it the day I was shot. And that's somewhat explained in the story because it was really sort of accidental that we ended up in a zone where there was a firefight going on. I also took money to an orphanage. I was asked to hand carry a check for $1,000 to an orphanage run by American priests in San Salvador. And maybe that's what saved me.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking that you couldn't have mailed it. I lived a year in Peru, and my mail was opened before I got it. I also think I was suspect because I was going in and out of the embassy there in Lima, and I think that probably made them wonder why we were there. So, and Peru is nothing like El Salvador. I can only imagine from your book what that must have been like. And I don't think you knew what you were getting into, did you, George?
Well, I think I did a lot of research before I went, and I talked to a lot of people, including a lot of church people who were trying to support the people of El Salvador. So to a certain extent, I knew that it was a war zone and that I had to be careful and that there were certain rules that you followed. But I don't think I realized I certainly didn't realize the extent of the war and how there was essentially fighting going on all over the country. And then, as my book points out, there were dead bodies turning up on the streets, including outside the hotel, every day. And so there was this campaign by the security forces to assassinate mostly young men.
And it didn't take long before you got shot. For Pete's sake, you practically just arrived in the country.
Yeah.
And you got shot.
Well, and I thought I was following the rules because I was with a CBS correspondent. I was at the time. I had been with him the entire day. He also had a film crew with him. In those days, they had a cameraman and a sound man. But that day, his crew had been assigned to a nationally known reporter who had flown in for a couple of stand-ups in front of the hotel. And so it was just him and I and our driver, Gilberto. Steve Patton, the CBS correspondent, he had been all over the world. He had just come from Beirut, which was a hot zone in the Middle East. And so I felt somewhat secure in that I was with people who had been there and knew what they were doing.
But now, you just mentioned the hotel, and I know in South American, well, countries, there are taxis out in front of the hotel. And so you just innocently just grabbed a taxi there in front of the hotel, right?
Yes.
At first.
Yes. And that was a mistake. And that's a kind of mistake that could be very problematic because, as I was later told by the correspondents that were there, the taxis in front of the hotel were all government informants, and they would report who they picked up and where they took them.
So you arranged to get a different driver, who's also an mm-hmm. interpreter, and this is how you made the acquaintance of someone that you dedicate this book to, the legacy of Gilberto Moran. And what happened to him?
Well, he's an interesting story, and I write about him in the book, and there's some very interesting coincidences, the first one being that we were both born on the same day in the same year.
In fact, I wondered sometimes if that was part of your, I mean, I could see several reasons that you would feel, have strong feelings about what happened to Gilberto, but you also shared his birthday, so I think that also contributed to this feeling of friendship, if that's the word I want to use, that you felt toward Gilberto Moran.
Right. Well, and it's interesting because nobody, I've talked to many of the journalists who were there at the time, and he was recommended by the NBC crew as somebody that I could use and as both a driver and interpreter. And this was critical, again, as I mentioned in the book, because just driving through the streets of El Salvador required a certain protocol. And particularly as you approached military who were everywhere. And so it was important to have somebody who was local, who knew what was going on, but also who understood the rules of engagement, which you know, started with, as soon as it started to get dark, you had better be off the streets everywhere. You always drove your windows down so that if a soldier shouted at you, you heard it. Because the next thing they would do if you didn't stop was to shoot. And that was that was the other thing that I guess I wasn't surprised, but there was sort of a rule, which is if you're a young man and you're dressed in civilian clothes, you are a suspected guerrilla, and it's okay to shoot you because no one's gonna investigate, and you always can just chalk it up as you shot a gorilla. And I think there's a certain amount of that in terms of why we got shot. Three young men walking down a road, a jungle road, near where there had been a firefight hours before.
My guest is former editor of the Chico News and Review, George Thurlow, and his book is El Salvador, Blood on All Our Hands. So you find yourself there in San Salvador is the capital. Just people wondering why we switch back and forth El Salvador and San Salvador. And on the cover of your book is a photograph of you the day you were shot. And you, well, tell us who took that photograph.
That photograph was taken by John Newhagen, who I've gotten to know even better. He was somewhat of a legend, and I talk about him in the book.
Now, you were a freelancer. You just go down there on your own, but he was not. Wasn't he CBS?
He was UPI.
Okay.
But I do want to make a point that I went down as a writer for the Woodland Daily Democrat. When I decided I was going to go and had done a lot of research, I went into my publisher's office, Ken Leek, a devout Catholic whose family had owned this newspaper for three generations. And I said, I want to take a vacation, and I want to take 2 weeks off and go to El Salvador. Well, as a devout Catholic, he was very familiar with what had happened to the nuns. He was very affected by it. And before I left, he handed me a check that covered all of my expenses. So I really wasn't a freelancer. I was really working for the Woodland Daily Democrat, although in the end, I wrote articles for many, many newspapers.
My guest is former editor of the Chico News and Review, George Thurlow. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, George Thurlow, who has written a book about being shot in El Salvador when he was a young journalist. So the photograph on the cover of your book was taken in a hospital there in San Salvador, Policlinica Hospital. And describe that cover for listeners, if you would, George.
Well, it's a picture of me just before I went into surgery. The Policlinica was the most modern hospital / clinic in El Salvador. And it still really felt like I was going into a 1950s operating room. I had wonderful treatment from the doctors there, but I had shrapnel all up and down my arm. And they indicated that I really needed to get to the United States and have treatment in case the shrapnel had embedded in any nerves. I should tell you this. It's a pretty graphic photo of me with blood on my hands. But I have to tell you, my editor argued long and hard for me not to use that photo.
Oh, really?
On the cover. Yeah, she just didn't. She didn't like it. And so, but it to me, it sort of emphasized the tone of the book, which is we all, including myself, have some responsibility for the bloodshed in El Salvador.
And that seemed to be the reason for your quest that goes throughout the book, because it seemed to me as a reader that that's what you felt. There was blood on your hands because of this young man named Gilberto Morán who died that day. You survived. He did not.
Exactly.
And it seemed like that was part of your quest to find where he was buried, to find his family, because you felt like you had blood on your hands. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you come back to the United States, and were they able to remove the shrapnel?
They were able to remove some. There's a lot that's still there, and it's funny because a couple of years ago, I had an X-ray taken of my left arm, and there's a piece of my shoulder that just glows like radioactive. I mean, it's a big chunk of metal, but fortunately, I've not had any problems with the shrapnel that's in my hand, on my shoulder, and my elbow.
So you come back to the United.
But let me say this about another interesting. And I'm not sure if I put this in the book or not. After my surgery in El Salvador, they gave me the shrapnel that they had taken out of my arm. And they just gave it to me as, okay, here's your souvenir of El Salvador. But I showed it to somebody in the military not long after that and said, you know, this is what hit me. What is this? And they said that it was pretty clear it was pieces of metal that had been packed into a shotgun shell and were used in certain rifles as a very effective anti-personnel because they came out of a rifle. And by the way, they're banned by international, you know, although I'm not sure how much effect that has, but essentially it's banned by international organizations because it is so devastating when it's used on people. That's essentially what I got. I mean, originally I thought maybe I'd been hit by a bullet that exploded in front of me. But after I showed these pieces to military people, they said, "Oh no, those are pieces of shrapnel from an anti-personnel shotgun shell."
So you come back to the United States and you get the surgery here, and you had been in Woodland, and you made your way to Chico to become editor of the Chico News and Review. And one would think, oh, good, here's George Thurlow is going to be our editor. That apparently was not the reception you got.
Well, the Chico News and Review was going through some really dramatic changes, both financially and in terms of its mission. And I came in as an outsider to the paper. I was brought by Jeff Von Cannell, who was really the guy who saved, he and his wife Deborah saved the Chico News and Review, because it was in financial distress, extreme. But there was a lot. There was a certain amount of distrust, and so I faced a little bit of rockiness when I came in. As in, the whole staff resigned.
Yes, that would surprise me. Whole Chico News and Review staff quit in protest of your having been hired.
Yeah. And I should say I have good relations with all of them now. And I understand. I understand what their motivations were. And I think they were seriously concerned that a progressive community newspaper was about to be turned into a shopper. And obviously that wasn't my interest.
Well, is this somewhat before you gained, I don't know if the word's notoriety, but your story appeared in publications all over the United States, right, in your photograph?
Yeah. And I can see why. There wasn't a huge, wave of affection because I had done this international reporting. I think the concern was, what's he going to do here in Chico, and is he going to take our, and it was a very storied newspaper. I mean, coming off of the campus and all of the political involvement it had, I think there was real concern by the editorial staff that that was going to change. And clearly it did not. We continued with a very progressive voice in what in the early 1980s was still somewhat of a conservative area.
So you have were the editor here of the Chico News and Review, and sometime after that, after 1991, mm-hmm. and I'm jumping ahead now to the year 2000,
sure.
And you have a section in your book that says, "My search begins." And
yes.
What was that search?
Well, in effect, I like the U.S. government, walked away from El Salvador, went to Chico, was immersed in all of the politics and all of the causes in Chico, and the fact that we had an incredibly good newspaper there, and pretty much walked away, not unlike our government, simply walked away from El Salvador. And in 2000, I don't know, because it was 2000, I thought, you know, I really need to return. And the quest for the grave is symbolic.
You say that as the 20th century closed, it seemed a time of new beginnings and stout resolutions. I'd put off confronting Gilberto's death for a long time. And you say you decided to begin your search for him in 2000.
Yes.
And
I thought in 2000, when I began, that it would be one trip to San Salvador, easily find where he was buried, you know, discover where his family had gone, and you know, wrap that part of my life up. Instead, it turned into what, more than 20 year search, all the way to where I found the journalist who carried his coffin to the grave. I tracked him down, found him, and he couldn't tell me where the cemetery was. And so, in essence, it's like all stories. It's about the search, not necessarily about the destination. And this was a 20-year search. And in the process, I was able to do some good things for people in El Salvador, and I wrote a lot about it. And but still feel like there is a responsibility that I have. And I still think, there, if this book goes out there and is widely circulated, I still think there's a chance that somebody named Moran is going to show up on my doorstep.
You even went to a war memorial there in San Salvador to see if his name was on that war memorial. It's like our memorial in Washington, D.C. had names on it. And you didn't find his name there.
His name is not there. Now, the name of a person that I wrote about, that I happened upon in Sacramento, who had disappeared, his name was there. So it was interesting to find his name. He had been kidnapped by, he was a doctor, and he had been kidnapped by the military, and he disappeared, never to be found again, which was the MO of the government. And as I point out in the book and demonstrate with photos, those were US helicopters, those were US bombs. The ammunition that was used in the now famous massacre at El Mazote came from a U.S. Arms plant in the Midwest. And so it's very likely that the bullets that hit me and Joaquin and Gilberto were all made in the United States. I mean, it's probably absolutely that, because they weren't getting their arms and munitions from anywhere else except the United States.
Yeah, and you mentioned that you could never be sure who was pulling the trigger down in El Salvador. So that, here you are, this reporter from Woodland and later from Chico, and you get to cover a big wig from Washington, D.C., a Secretary of State, George.
Yes. Yes, that was quite interesting.
So how did that go for you? I didn't mention her name.
She came, and Condoleezza Rice, she came and she delivered the standard spiel, which was we're going to continue to support you in your fight against the spread of communism. And thank you very much. And the main reason she was there was that El Salvador was one of like four or five countries in the whole world that sent a contingent of troops, and contingent meaning a dozen or so, to Iraq. And her trip was partly to thank them for their show of support for the Bush war in Iraq. But it truly demonstrated that the highest levels of U.S. government are still I don't know what to tell you. They turned their back. I mean, everybody in a high ranking, they had evidence of Salvadoran soldiers committing massacres. They had evidence that they had killed the nuns. They had evidence that they had killed the Bishop Romero, who was revered in El Salvador, and our government did nothing. Our government essentially said, highest levels of our government, including Rice, essentially said, we're going to allow that. It's because it's a war with communism.
Now, speaking the irony of that, is, oh,
yes, go ahead.
Did you start to say the irony is? Because that's what occurred to me.
At the end of the book, I talk about going back. I was back there just not many months ago. The Chinese communist government has given El Salvador millions upon millions of dollars for projects, including a massive library across from the main government square, irrigation projects, everything.
And that's why we got involved in El Salvador to fight communism.
To stop them, right. And yet now I have to tell you, nobody cares. I mean, nobody, you know.
You know what else, speaking of what's going on now, is the president declared a Bitcoin economy. Bitcoin there.
Yeah. Well, he's a bit of a interesting player. But what he will be remembered for is, and it's part of what we're seeing across Latin America, but also in other parts of the world, his fight against the gangs, which again, all the roads of Salvadoran gangs, their paths that they took all lead through the U.S. We helped foster these gangs. He's locked up 60,000 young people under the auspices of cracking down on gangs. And
he plans to run again for a new term.
Oh, yeah. Even though he's barred by he just ran and was just reelected, even though he was barred from serving a second term. So he's there for life now. Of course, the irony is that across the border in Nicaragua, where you had a socialist, Daniel Ortega, elected president, who's now become just as authoritarian as any right-wing despot in Latin America. But locking up 60,000 young people, and the populace loves it.
Yeah, that's really hard. You say he's the most popular leader in Latin America.
Yes, he is. Oh, he is.
Well, I mentioned that you taught journalism here at the at Chico State University, and you also mentioned that the guy who took your photograph that's on the cover of your book also became a professor of journalism, and this was at the University of Maryland. So I thought that was an interesting little aside that that John Newhagen also taught journalism. Well, are there any parting thoughts that you think we should know from you, George?
No, other than we as the American people, I think, have a very short memory. And whether it's a short memory of just 4 years ago and who was leading the country.
Well, I even computed how few people were even born when you went down there, George.
Well, <yeah. laughs>
when you went down to El Salvador, there's so many people that I know were not even born then. So they don't remember.
And I'm surprised by people who were born there who say, you know, I was around there. I never realized that it was quite as bad as you describe it. So I think we need to do a better job as a society in kind of learning our own history.
And you give Ambassador Robert White, you say he was the only U.S. government somebody who told the truth. So that's one thing. You've told us the truth, George.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So I would love if people read this book. I want to make sure people understand there's a price tag on it, but it will nowhere cover the cost of producing the book. I'm interested in people reading the book. I'm interested in being a part of the history of El Salvador.
Well,
yes, go ahead.
I was just going to say, since you mentioned that, the publisher is a Chico publisher, Stansberry Publishing, located here in Chico.
And I want to thank Stansberry. I want to thank
Steve Metzger. Yeah, I know you acknowledge him.
Yeah, he was very, very, very helpful in helping me sort of put together this book, and also connecting me with Larry at Stansberry.
Somebody else who wrote for the Chico News and Review, and when he heard I was going to be talking to you, Richard Parker said to give you his regards.
Small world.
Yes, Richard, it is.
From Santa Barbara.
So,
and of course, I want to thank David Hurst, who's also in Chico. David, who worked for Moon Publishing when it was based in Santa Barbara, did the layout and the design of the book, and he did a fantastic job. So I definitely want to thank him.
Let me give the title of your book again. The title is El Salvador, Blood on All Our Hands, and the author is George Thurlow. Thank you, George.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for putting on such an important public radio report.
Thank you. After a break, I'll be talking to author and retired professor Robert Jackson, who has written a fictional account of the Jefferson State Rebellion. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Retired Professor Robert Jackson taught political science and was a dean at Chico State University. He has published research on the political economy of the Sacramento Valley. Besides his academic work, Professor Jackson has served in nonprofit organizations, and these experiences inspired him to write a book of fiction, The Jefferson State Rebellion. Robert Jackson, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy.
And your friends probably call you Bob. So
that's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Now, I mentioned that your book is fiction, but it seems to me that it could be true.
Well, I've tried to use current circumstances to create the structure for the novel. I think what is really important, what I've done, is that Northern California is a character in the book. That is like Michael Conley uses L.A. as a character in his stories, or Penny Louise uses Quebec. I use Northern California because Northern California is an extremely important part of the entire political economy of the United States.
Well, you do have characters in this book, but I would like to give credit to your illustrator of the cover, because Steve Fershad is a favorite when it comes to illustrating books, and you have an illustration by him on the cover. And now there's an animal on the cover.
Yes, that's the California bear. The cover depicts the flag of California being ripped apart by Northern California and Southern California interests over water. And as the water cascades out through this broken flag, you'll see there's two X's in it. Those are symbols of the Jefferson State movement. The double X's are symbolic of the double cross people in Northern California feel they receive from the South State.
Well, speaking of animals, there's one. I learned a word in Russian that I never knew, the word for wolf. And how did that enter into the story?
Well, I wanted to have showing the diversity of California's population. My characters represent a lot of different ethnic backgrounds, immigrant backgrounds. So one of the key sub-characters is a man named Andrei Volkov, and he is Russian immigrant, and Volkov is Russian for wolf.
My guest is retired professor Robert Jackson, Bob Jackson, and he's written a nonfiction work, The Jefferson State Rebellion. And I mentioned the characters. You mentioned your main character. I guess you would consider Northern California your main character?
Yes, A.J. Donaldson, and who is a state senator. He's a fourth-generation rancher and a first-generation politician. His ranch I have placed over west of Willows in kind of a rural area. His wife is Rachel Rodriguez. Her mother was a Mexican immigrant, and their marriage is a key element in how they survive this set of militia activities that disrupt the water flow from Northern California to the south. What I tried to imagine, we always see these events taking place elsewhere in the world. What would it be like if it happened right here in the region where your listeners are located? Well, when it's militarized, when normal movement over bridges and into public buildings is disrupted, when the political focus of the country is focused on us, when the President of the United States gets involved in manipulating events for his or her own political agenda. So I try to look at the near future and what happened, what would it be like if it happened here?
You know what else I appreciate, something I appreciated in your book was often we see maps like road maps and they have highways. But I like the fact that your maps are very instructive. You might mention what some of the maps are for
those. Yes, the Geographical Information Center at Chico State designed these maps for the purpose of these books. And so what I tried to show is that water is a central issue in California. It's the same thing as oil would be to Saudi Arabia. You cannot think of California without thinking about the transfer of water from Northern California to the south. And the three largest dams, reservoirs in California are in this listening area. And the two main water projects in California, the Central Valley Project has its headwaters at Shasta Dam and the State Project at Oroville. These are essential to the vibrancy of the state economy, especially the agricultural economy, which is the largest in the country. And so a disruption of that movement of water from these reservoirs to Southern California would throw the state into a major turmoil. And that's what this book's about.
Now, you mentioned that this is all taking place in Northern California. Your maps have all these towns around us, that so we're familiar with them. But it seems to me that your story is also could benefit other states that have dry climates that are subject to drought. And it seems like you're saying, okay, you other guys, pay attention to what's going on here.
Yes, exactly. And, of course, the Colorado River disputes and reallocation of that water is central also to the vibrancy of Southern California. What I've tried to do is show that there's been a long movement over 80 years to separate California into at least two states. It started back in 1941. And let me read just a short section from the book that describes the formation of this concept of the state of Jefferson. We're in a meeting where this scene takes place, and State Senator Donaldson's asked to give a brief history.
Now, when you say we, you mean we readers are watching this scene take place. And where and who is this scene you're going to be telling us?
It's right after the first domestic terrorist disruption of the water conveyance system. An emergency meeting's been called, and our rural state senator is suddenly thrust into this room with all the big shots of the state. And he's asked to tell us about, because there's a proclamation about the Jefferson state behind this action.
And we might mention that your protagonist, the human character, is a longtime rancher, so he knows all about that, but he's new at being a politician.
Exactly. Exactly. He said, over the years, I've talked to a lot of people about it. This is the state of Jefferson. Here's a short version. The idea of the state of Jefferson began in 1941 as a publicity stunt. The leaders of Siskiyou County wanted more state money to build roads to develop mineral resources. When they didn't get it, they'd issued an attention-grabbing demand, more money or we'll form a new state. The editor of the San Francisco Chronicle got wind of this and thought it'd be a great story. He sent Stanton Delaplane to Yreka. It's my understanding that this fellow Delaplane was not only good at reporting the news, but better at embellishing it. On behalf of the publicity-hungry county leaders, he wrote a proclamation of independence and helped organize a roadblock on Highway 99 for locals to hand out the proclamation. For a week, Delaplane sent so-called dispatches to the Chronicle, later earned a Pulitzer Prize for his creative journalism. After the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, the hullabaloo faded. 50 years later, new grievances brought the movement back to life.
This is retired Professor Robert Jackson, Bob Jackson. This book is The Jefferson State Rebellion, and he just read us a section from The Jefferson State Rebellion.
One of the things that I really tried to do in this book is show that the grievances of Northern California are real. That is, I'm not in a position to appropriate the Jefferson State movement. They can speak for themselves, but I have done my very best to illustrate why people in Northern California feel this sense of almost being colonized by Southern California. That is, the wealth exists here, water, the key resource. And yet very little of that wealth remains in this area. It's all been developed for transfer out of the state. The wealth is created elsewhere from the water. We aren't paid for the water. We don't receive many benefits from this water. And yet it's the lifeblood of all of California. So I've tried my very best using these maps to illustrate where the water is located, where the reservoirs are located, where the aqueducts and conveyance canals are located, how the population is distributed. The northern portion of California, NorCal, is everything north of Interstate 80. And yet there's only 2.5 million people living in this area, which is the size of the state of Arkansas. We have very little influence in the state legislature. And so there's a resentment that decisions outside of this region, whether it has to do with timber policy, it has to do with water policy, it has to do with all of these different kinds of things, the spotted owl, the Klamath River restoration. These are all issues that Northern Californians feel very strongly about, but they don't feel their voices being heard anywhere.
Well, I think readers of your book, even though it's supposedly nonfiction, will learn a lot from this book. Thank you for writing this book, Professor.
Oh, you're welcome.
My guest has been Robert Jackson, Bob Jackson. His latest book is the fictional story of the Jefferson State Rebellion. Thank you, Professor.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
I would also like to thank my first guest, a former editor of the Chico News and Review, George Thurlow. And next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Golden hour. Sunrise, sunset, yin and yang, faith and fear, sanity and insanity, light and dark contending. Most days, the light in me rises with the sun. I can leave home, even myself, led out by creativity, kindness, and generosity, all wrapped in colorful scarves. Other days, the darkness arrives from within. I fold inside myself, cold-blooded, immobile, selfish, mute, colors leached to gray. Darkness and light, I do wonder about the final consummation. Which one are we poured into at death? Maybe we enter a final world held in the golden hour, when the sun blazes on the treetops and the colors of earth and sky sing as day and night find their most beautiful balance. Hilary Lindauer Vasey.
The Pregnant Virgin of Remedios. Perhaps we are not smart enough to know that spontaneous combustions are not really phenomena of nature, but rather unsanctioned miracles like pregnant virgins who float above pews, clicking castanets while maintaining proper form, entre el humo y las sombras, pivoting in and out of serpentine smoke, the ascension and descension of the arms, the hands flittering in candlelight, the children wide-eyed behind the pillars, giggling and tapping their feet, the shadows trying to keep pace with the delicate toes, la alegría de la vida, la dulzura del amor, la pasión del flamenco, ay. But when the chimes of the Angelus ring, the Virgin, with her bulging belly, returns to her pedestal, her breasts rising and falling, rising and falling to the cadence of the bells. Linda Serrato.
The old picture. The old picture from January long past. We sat on the couch within the warm walls of home, with gifts in our hands, grinning bigger than the cat through the looking glass. Now the years have grown empty, like the gifts we once opened, as I sit alone every cold January, wondering if you were happy with the life that you led. Didn't think how we might feel when you take the road up the hill. I sit alone, dark in the void, with the only evidence in my hands, a tiny rectangle of glossy paper, an old memory from January long past. Brandon Quinones.
Sacramento Valley summer and Indiana girls' perceptions. It's brazen, this clarity of light, this immediacy of objects, this transparency of air. Here, no gauze of moisture softens or protects the waking eye, the guarded heart, from what will not be denied. No supple green lies between us and bone of rock, of limb. Only the meadowlark's song arcs, supple as spring leaves across the sun-struck sky. The sweet scent of dried grasses whispering. Amy Gaffney.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.